This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that. But prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, will the proposed XM-Sirius satellite radio merger send the FCC into orbit? Then, Hollywood is littered with rich guys who thought they could beat the system. Is producer Bob Yari just another easy mark? Or is he the hustler? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. It's the Hollywood News Caravan, on demand. 3 weeks ago, Viacom insisted YouTube remove over 100,000 unauthorized clips from its website. To add insult to possible litigation, last week the conglomerate, which owns MTV, VH1, Nickelodeon, and Paramount Pictures, inked a content-sharing deal with the brand-new video-sharing site, Juiced. Juiced will cut Viacom in on its revenue, which will cut out the hugely popular YouTube. The only downside for consumers? Unlike YouTube, you can't upload clips to Juiced. We say if the stuff is free, high quality, and legal, Juiced may rule the roost. Early shots in the 2008 presidential race could be heard echoing off the Hollywood Hills last week. Music mogul David Geffen co-hosted a reception for Barack Obama with his DreamWorks co-founder Steven Spielberg and Jeffrey Katzenberg that raked in $1.3 million for the Illinois senator's White House bid. Squirting lemon juice into a paper cut, Geffen lambasted Obama's opponent, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, and her husband, what's-his-name, in the New York Times. Quote, "Everybody in politics lies, but they do it with such ease, it's troubling." Even as David Geffen got behind one black pioneer last week, his studio was busy kissing the behind of another, Motown Records founder Berry Gordy Jr. Gordy has been mum about his portrayal in Dreamgirls as the payola-passing, girl-group-pimping Curtis Taylor Jr., but clearly, Gordy's lawyers haven't been. In a full-page ad in Daily Variety last week, DreamWorks wrote, quote, "For any confusion that resulted from our fictional work, we apologize to Mr. Gordy." Finally, Warner Music Group and Sony BMG Music have discovered that while dead men tell no tales, they can file lawsuits. Concert promoter Bill Graham died in a helicopter crash in 1991, but his Bill Graham archives lives on, selling millions of dollars worth of rock memorabilia and streaming audio from concert tapes last year. But in December, the Grateful Dead, The Doors, and Led Zeppelin all filed suit against the Graham Archive, alleging copyright infringement. Last week, the Graham Archives filed a counterclaim accusing both Warner Music and Sony BMG of conspiring to crush the Archives' business. In other words, the Ungrateful Dead are now suing the Grateful Dead. And vice versa. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later on the show, an in-depth interview with the man who produced last year's best picture, Crash, but didn't get an Oscar for it. But next, will the proposed satellite radio merger send the FCC into orbit? Last year, Sirius Satellite Radio trumpeted that they expected the fourth quarter to be their, quote, first ever positive free cash flow quarter. Of course, a little black ink is not going to wipe out the nearly $3 billion they've spent trying to keep their satellite business aloft. And XM, the only competitor to Sirius, recorded two-thirds of $1 billion in losses in 2005 alone. But after 5 years of trying to spend each other to death, the once-bitter rivals now say they want to get married. The Federal Communications Commission, of course, will have the last say. We talked to former FCC Chairman Michael Powell to learn more. Michael Powell, welcome to The Business.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Let's talk about the timing of this merger between Sirius and XM. Do you think that the timing has something to do with sort of the political realities in Washington?
My best guess is that it does in part. I think that this is a merger that has been talked about for many years. And I think you probably want to do it at a time in which you believe you have enough time in years and months to work through any issues that might arise prior to a major election.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you were a commissioner on the FCC from 1997 to 2001 and the chairman of the commission from 2001 to 2005.
Mm-hmm.
We were most interested in speaking with you because you, of course, helped derail the planned merger between EchoStar and DirecTV, the two competitive satellite television services. What are the similarities between these two deals, these two mergers, and how are they not the same?
Well, they're similar in some very obvious ways. There are only two licensees in the market. Both provide a nationwide multimedia offering, and that were the two to merge, there would only be one employing that kind of technology and providing that specific type of service. So they're very similar in that regard. The case with EchoStar and DirecTV over television included the additional component of the cable industry. Here, you don't really have the equivalent of the cable industry in the radio space. The most significant provider of a similar service is local terrestrial broadcasters. A big issue will be whether the government chooses to include them in the competitive market analysis. In the television case, local television broadcasters were not included as part of the competitive base because there are a lot of differences. One's inherently local, it's limited by geography, the nature of the product is somewhat different.
Just ask Howard Stern, right?
Right, just as Howard Stern. That's a good point, too, because the content regulatory environment is different. So certain things that can only be on satellite, for example, couldn't be on broadcast. And so whether they are, the government will ask, are they really substitutes for each other? If they are, then the merger is less problematic because there are a lot of local radio stations. If the government chooses not to count them, then you can see that the merger looks extremely concentrating. The other thing is the nature of the product is different. Television content is similar, but certainly a different kind of medium than music and talk radio. And then I think the third thing, which is the most interesting to my mind, is the arrival of new media technologies and whether they're baked yet. I've seen many transactions which the companies asserted that the government should not be concerned with their merger because of the arrival of new media or new forms of communication, and the government to date really has never accepted that argument.
Yeah, that's sort of the Bill Gates defense, isn't it? We could be out of business tomorrow if some kid in a garage comes up with
a better
operating system.
And you know, I think this is getting actually harder and harder because, you know, is the iPod a substitute for radio or is it complementary? Is it really disruptive or does it stimulate more listening and more watching? And I think this is this kind of soup we're in trying to understand the emergence of these new technologies. But antitrust review, unfortunately, is very much a snapshot in time. It doesn't tend to take into account a whole bunch of predictions about the changing trends and the direction. The companies are going to have to convince the antitrust division that that stuff is here and now. And it is an effective competitor, particularly in keeping the two radio satellite providers from raising prices. And that's going to be a tricky argument.
Now, a lot of people say this approval that, of course, we should caution people, has not been approved yet. But the potential for this deal to be approved would be tantamount to a government bailout of two companies that spent hundreds of millions of dollars like drunken sailors. do you buy that analysis, basically, that these guys basically were profligate in their spending and giving Howard Stern a $500 million deal and, you know, Oprah and Bob Dylan and on and on? Do you think that that's rewarding bad behavior?
I think that's a Wall Street story. I mean, I think that a lot on Wall Street are pressing for this merger and have encouraged it for many of those reasons. But I think when you go to the government forum of evaluating the competitive effects, it doesn't much matter whether the reasoning behind their desire to come together is because they've screwed up or because they really are strategically aligned. You know, nothing in the antitrust laws doesn't prevent two strong competitors coming together for offensive reasons, if you will, as long as enough competition remains. Similarly, antitrust doesn't concern itself with trying to bail somebody out who's otherwise made a bad deal if to come together would be anti-competitive.
Well, then one last quick question I'll ask you. Do you think this will pass?
You know, I think when you look at the composition of the commission, nothing's guaranteed there. I mean, I think there's sufficient range of views on these kinds of issues that I can see combinations that would take this in either direction. So I think it's going to be a very intriguing case to watch for that reason.
Michael Powell is the former chairman of the FCC and now head of the Powell Group. We reached him at his offices in Washington. Michael, thanks for being on The Business.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Depending on who you talk to, producer Bob Yari is either a brave indie producer with extraordinary vision and sublime taste, a major egomaniac, or a man just one half step ahead of the bill collector. He may be all three. He gets the first label by producing the grown-up movies that the studios won't even gamble on anymore. Films like The Illusionist, The Painted Veil, and perhaps most notably, last year's Best Picture Oscar winner, Crash. Yari wasn't awarded an Oscar for producing Crash, and he gets his egomaniac label for his high-profile fight with the Academy and the Producers Guild over the way they determine who is and is not a producer. He's sometimes called slippery by his talent, who accuse him of paying his bills late or not at all. No matter who you believe, Yari is a fascinating guy with a fascinating background. A Persian Jew who left Iran when he was a child, he returned and then fled just before the Shah was overthrown. He studied cinematography in the States and then came to Hollywood to be a filmmaker, first working as a production assistant and eventually directing his own film, Mind Games, in 1989. When his film was, quote, trivialized by the studios, he left show business and became a successful real estate developer. With a master plan and a pocket full of cash, he returned to Hollywood with the intent of creating the first real indie studio in years. The early days were rough. There were a number of disasters, primarily Alec Baldwin's 2001 directing debut, The Devil and Daniel Webster, which has yet to be released. As a neophyte, Yari was smart enough to form partnerships with respected veteran show business producers, but none of these relationships lasted. Even so, he's produced some 35 films since he came to Hollywood around 2001. Of those that have been released, he says about half have shown a profit.
Bob Yari, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
Now, Hollywood has no shortage of sort of guys who've made a pile of cash and want to become the next Harvey Weinstein or something like that. When you came back, what was your plan?
You know, I like to say that Hollywood is one of the few industries I found that's kind of institutionalized the con. It's an industry that will take someone that doesn't really know the business but has money, invite them in, kind of strip them out, and then toss them out the other side. And I think it's become institutionalized because there's such a long line of people waiting to step in for the guy who's just stepped out. It just doesn't stop. And it's not just individuals. It even happens on a large institutionalized basis also, which is, you know, you have the insurance companies coming into the game, losing their shirts and leaving. You have the Japanese. You have the
Germans.
The Germans, the tax funds.
It's nice to see the Axis powers kind of finally getting their due, though. First the Japanese, then the Germans.
That's an interesting
way to
look
at it. Then the insurance companies.
It.
It's all the bad guys. You know, it's sort of divine justice, if you
right.
ask me.
Well, you know, it's spread pretty evenly. There are a lot of good guys that come in and
kind of
lose money, too. But anyhow, knowing that, it was a fascinating challenge for me to see if I can build a business model. Having the experience of film from a core standpoint, how films are made, and then having the business skills I had built over the past, at that time, 10, 15 years, it was an interesting challenge to see if I could beat that formula.
What were you bringing with you? How big was your bankroll? And what were you willing to stake from your personal fortune to attempt this dream?
I think the perception out there was that here's another billionaire. I mean, there's been quotes that, you know, I'm nowhere near it. I mean, far, far from it. So
people say the same thing about me.
Yeah,
all the time.
I know, it happens to us all. But I mean, it's odd because all you have to look at is the Forbes list, and
right.
you won't see me there. My model is one that requires bank loans for each film, and a little bit of equity. But it's not as someone was just writing checks for movies. I wish I could do that, but I couldn't. And so I built a model that was primarily based on foreign sales, meaning the standard independent financing model of pre-selling foreign rights and then taking your contracts to a financial institution and basically financing your production.
Your philosophy seems to be one of success can only come from a broad slate of pictures, similar to the same model that the studios employ, but on an independent level. the headache for indie producers has always been that the studios have sort of unlimitedly deep pockets, and you don't. So is there a danger of spreading yourself too thin?
Oh, 100%. In fact, I think I got there. We got to a point where we probably anticipated wrongly when our bank loans would close in the cash flow process of making multiple films. And what we found was bank loans were closing at times after the film was completed, which seems silly. But the reality of the situation is by the time you get the very, very complicated negotiations between the foreign distributor, the bond company, the bank, and ourselves completed, you would be in that situation. So we got into a position where we started getting very behind on cash flow, and we were late paying vendors, and ultimately we caught up. I mean, we fixed the problem, but very much like you said, it is without deep pockets, it's very, very difficult to fund a slate of films.
You're caught up now. You believe everybody's paid and everything's good.
We never got into a position where we didn't pay someone.
Right.
We were late paying, but you know, we caught up, and now I think our last 5 or 6 films have been very smooth because now we've learned to anticipate the lags in bank loan closing.
Does that hurt your relationships in a business that's all about relationships?
No question. No question. I mean, I think more so than I even expected, when you have a misstep or if you have a delayed payment, the repercussions on that are tremendous because there's a chain reaction. There's talent, and if they're affected, they look at their agents and they're, why did you let this happen? And their attorneys, why did you let this happen? So if they even get payment late, there is repercussions that kind of ripple throughout the system and affect you, your relationships, your reputation. And we're working to repair them because, like you said, it's a relationship business. And you ultimately will thrive on your reputation.
Do you sort of have maybe the luxury of not caring about that so much because you work with a lot of untested directors? I'm thinking of, you know, Richard Shepard, who directed The Matador, and Paul Haggis, who had only written before but had never directed and directed Crash for you. Neil Berger, who directed The Illusionist, only had sort of one esoteric film under his belt. Does this obviate the need to curry favor? Can you sort of have the luxury of not caring so much as, you know, studios that need to send over fruit baskets and make everything nice?
To a certain extent, I think that's possibly true. But I think in general, you are hurt by not having good relations, or else ultimately you will be deprived of something, whether it's an actor that you want to ultimately put in a movie that's perfect. You know, there's some place that you will pay that price. And I think it's going to take work to get there. I mean, sometimes it takes years to prove that up. I mean, a great example is there was an article in the New York Times about Crash, about payments not going out. And ultimately, there are audits being done, and those are going to show that when we got money from Lionsgate, which in that case was a distributor, the monies were distributed as contracted. So when everyone has their checks now, I mean, if you call Paul Haggis, hopefully he's going to tell you, yeah, I've been getting paid continuously and I'm happy, but that's not going to end up in the New York Times. So it's very hard to undo a negative, true or false.
We did contact director Paul Haggis to verify Bob Yari's claim that he's finally paying Haggis for his work on Crash. Haggis' carefully crafted response was emailed from Morocco, where he's shooting his new film. Quote, yes, we are being paid profits, and the majority of participants are happy to be receiving their profits. Unquote. Coming up after a short break, more with Bob Yari about what it means to be a producer in Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. In just the few years since he arrived in Hollywood, Bob Yari has produced films like The Painted Veil, The Illusionist, and The Matador. But he's most known for an unusually public and vitriolic spat with the Motion Picture Academy over their refusal to recognize him as a producer of Crash. His battle with them and producer Kathy Schulman, who did get the Oscar, is still making headlines. You didn't get an Oscar for Crash.
Right.
And you sued. And that got rebuffed. What are you trying to accomplish with this litigation?
The perception out there is that here's a bitter guy who wants his Oscar. Well, I'm not asking for an Oscar. Not that I wouldn't want one. That's not the gist of the suit. And neither is damages. I'm not trying to be compensated for something that didn't happen. I think it was extremely unjust. And the thing that frustrated me the most was the way it was handled. Meaning, by the way, I don't agree with the PGA's definition of what a producer should be, because the PGA's definition is
We're talking about the Producers Guild of America. Yeah.
Their definition is highly tilted towards a studio producer's definition of
what producing. A producer is. Yeah.
Right.
Now, to be clear, the PGA, the Producers Guild of America, says that you need to exercise decision-making power in one of four areas: development, pre-production, production, or post-production and marketing, right?
Right.
Now, you're fighting this on what? On the merits of what they define a producer as?
Absolutely. And in fact, I was saying I don't agree with their definition, but once you use their definition, I didn't exercise 50% as they require. I exercised 90 to 100% because I found the project, I tied it up, you know, I put all the elements together. I'm the one who stood behind Paul Haggis as the director when other people didn't want to work with him. Even talent would come on and say, we're worried about a first-time director. And through the process, I had 100% control over both the creative and business elements and down to the post. But I didn't sit on the set. I couldn't. So my problem with what they did was I had all this evidence, basically, of what I did, my position. I had declarations from people like Paul Haggis and the distributor of the film, Lionsgate. I mean, a tremendous amount of evidence that I submitted, and all that I was told was no. No explanation, no showing me of any evidence contradicting my evidence, and no telling me who made this decision. And I was never given the opportunity to go either make my case. I asked for it. I asked to be allowed to speak to whoever's making the decision. But everything was done in secrecy. Secret evidence, secret decision makers, secret decision. No one is telling the Academy you made the wrong decision on what film to award or what cinematographer to, you know, that's absolutely their decision-making process. Their rules are their decision-making. But once you take on to yourself the task of elimination, in essence, meaning if someone's a credited producer on a film and you're now going to go in front of a billion people and say, this person is not a real producer. And so you're basically saying he's a fraud or she's a fraud. So the court case went towards saying to the Academy and the PGA, your process needs to be an open and fair process. And that's it. And many times I've offered them, change your process and I'll drop the lawsuit. I've even offered to them something as simple as this, which is take my evidence, take the PGA criteria, give it to a third party arbitrator. And if I was wrong, if I didn't qualify, I'll drop my suit and I'll publicly apologize. And if you were wrong, meaning if that arbitrator says, I did qualify under the PGA criteria, then change your system. Don't apologize. Don't give me an Oscar. Just change your system because it's wrong.
Whatever the case, in your judgment, what is the definition of a producer?
Well, I'm going to answer that. But before I do, I think that there is an absolute legitimate reason to go and tackle producer credits. The whole issue of credits being unfairly given is one that has some validity to it. I think in the past there has been some abuse of it where people have not been a producer in any capacity. They've been a manager of a star, or they've been someone who basically just writes a check and, you know, had nothing to do with technically producing the film. Those are wrong. Those hurt everyone, because those that really function as producers are hurt by that. And I'm not in any way trying to suggest that that's not a noble cause. It is. That is something that does need to be fixed. But the PGA started such an overzealous process to try and rein that in. They've gone way overboard, and now they're hurting very well-established producers doing their jobs. Back to the definition. The definition of a producer is a very unruly definition. It's very difficult to rein it in, because there's so many different areas that the definition changes. It certainly changes for a studio producer to an independent producer. A studio producer, in essence, is the person who finds the material, assembles or partially assembles a team, the director, the writer, possibly even a star or two, and then goes to the studio and says, are you going to make this movie? The studio says yes or no. And they have no other way to make the film if the studio says no. So if it's a yes, then that producer becomes kind of the liaison between the studio and the production itself. So they go sit on the set. But the studio is exercising ultimate control. So that producer really doesn't have a final cut or say-so to hire and fire without the studio's directive. On the other hand, an independent producer is the boss. I mean, he's the guy who's responsible. Not only is he going to find the material, assemble the team, he's also going to find the financing. He's going to be the one in charge of creative. Is the director doing his job or not? He's going to make the decision to fire him or not, or who the stars are going to be.
He's as much a studio as a producer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's such an important function, because the film doesn't get made unless that guy puts the financing together, finds the distribution, oversees, I mean, everything, A to Z, he's involved with. So how do you start breaking that down between the early work and the final work? Well, you know, is someone a producer who goes out there and develops scripts and brings them to a point where they're then taken by another team and made into a film? Well, yes. I mean, by definition, many of the biggest producers in Hollywood, that's all they did. They developed the projects. They brought them to the point where they got to production. Now, they may have been around for production, but their responsibilities and true work was not as significant. And then there are producers that are hired by studios just out of the blue. They had nothing to do with the development of a project. And then they take it from the point of green lighting to delivering the film to the studio, but they have nothing to do with marketing. Is that person a producer? Yes, that's also a function of a producer. Then is someone a producer who's brought in and oversees the entire marketing, down to, you know, selling the film to TV stations on the independent side? I think that person's a producer also. So my definition is much, much broader than what the PGA likes to define as a producer.
Depending who you talk to, Bob Yari is a producer. We think he is. Bob, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And that's The Business. Matt Holdsman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Club Red Esser Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 7-passenger MDX. More information is available at acura.com.